Welcome to Disrespect, exploring the stigma around disability, providing information and interviews to entertain and challenge you who may care about or care for or have become someone with a disability. In the following interview for Disrespect with social justice lawyer Sarah Chartall, Sarah drops her voice repeatedly, and in response, you may want to up your volume at the start of the interview because she has a lot that's interesting to say about denial of benefits, not by overt disqualification, but by process. Disrespect welcomes Roach Schwartz lawyer Sarah Chartall's explanation of ODSP Section 17, which limits retroactive benefits for disabled people to 4 months, when reviews and applications often take much longer.
The limits of 17 can work in two directions.
Mm-hmm.
It can limit retroactivity to 4 months retroactive or to 1 month after the decision, right?
1 month after the decision.
Right.
How do you limit retroactivity to 1 month? In other words, no retroactivity.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Well, apparently they're claiming now that they have eliminated the 4 month back limit, but you haven't seen this yet.
And I haven't seen it yet, put it that way.
Yeah.
Okay. And you see, the problem is it can go 4 months back or 1 month
forward,
post,
yeah,
depending on what point in the process somebody gets in.
Okay. How does it depend on what point in the process they get in?
Well, for example, if somebody applies in January,
yeah,
let's just do the basic math. Applies doesn't mean you get your papers. It means that's the point at which you send them back in.
Right.
Okay? There's date stamped January 1. If it takes them 10 months before they read that file, and they don't make a decision until, let's say, a month after that, that would get us to 11 months, which would give us to November. Right? In that case, the retroactivity will be paid November, October, till July. Right?
Okay.
So they get from July to November, 4 months.
Right.
If they apply January 1,
mm-hmm,
and it's allowed on April 3,
mm-hmm,
they will not be paid from January 1, so that person has lost 6 months.
I see.
The importance in this is to ask for an invalidity of the entire section and just simply say benefits back to date of application. The other government money programs, there are at least three sets.
Mm-hmm.
One, of course, is OW.
Mm-hmm.
The next is Guaranteed Annual Income Supplement Gains,
right,
which is paid to seniors. And then there are a number of programs paid for children with severe disabilities.
Okay.
All of those pay back to date of application.
Hmm.
This is the only program that limits how much somebody gets to either 4 months pre or 1 month post. So there's a question. How come this program?
Yeah, well, what do you...
Everything else, you basically get it from the date of application.
Why do you think this program is targeted?
Oh, well, I think it's because this is perhaps the most expensive of the lot. I mean, if we understand that the programs that are really expensive for government,
yeah,
are programs that involve health and age.
And they're growing.
And they're growing, because the more of us that are older, the more of us tend to be people with disabilities. It includes both health care and pensions.
Right.
But that essentially the things that are really expensive for the state are health care, and health care is also dependent by age.
Right.
We consume more health care. We have more health problems the older we are.
Yeah.
I think this is a set of benefits that are contingent upon health crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing that triggers somebody's fall into severe disability is usually, at least in my experience and everyone else's, a health crisis. People don't just sort of bloom,
yes,
totally disabled. Those are usually folks who are congenitally disabled. They usually move on to benefits when they're 18.
Right.
For the rest of us, we spend most of our adult life in various states of health.
Right.
And for some of us, we acquire throughout our lives a series of disabilities, usually one that comes in on the other.
All right.
Now, most people support themselves through employment for most of their lives.
Right.
What does happen for some of us is that at some point in our lives, usually when we're older, we acquire so many health problems that we're no longer able to sustain employment. At the point at which we can no longer sustain employment, then the question becomes sort of how do we support ourselves?
That's clear.
If you step back from the question, for those of us who end up being unable to work, not with things with which we were born, but with things that come into our lives or become worse in our lives later on, the question is how do we move from one to the other? All of the work that we've done.
Because there's a gap in support there.
Yeah. And all of the work that we've done, the question really becomes, you know, you get sick.
Mm-hmm.
You go through a crisis and you can no longer work. What do you actually do immediately at the point of crisis? Do you have any money coming in?
Yeah.
Do you have anywhere to fall?
Yeah.
And what happens with ODSP, because the disability adjudication process, the process, the actual bureaucracy, the administrative process of the whole thing.
Which was set in place shortly after the Tories were elected.
There was a different administrative process before. This one was set up by Anderson. It's
right.
Modeled on programs they've done in the States. It's set up. The programs were completely redesigned. The
yes.
FBA system, the Family Benefit Act that preceded ODSP, was substantially different than ODSP.
Right.
They're not equivalent one to the other.
Right.
The province decided it was going to divide FBA into two different systems.
Yeah.
One which would be short-term benefits for people who are presumed to be able to find work, but haven't found it,
mm-hmm.
and then the ODSP system, which would be specifically for people with disabilities.
Yes.
Now, the administrative process that they put in place is a quagmire. Now, what's so successful about all this, and from their perspective, when one starts to talk about administrative design, people's eyes glaze over, even before you've started the conversation. If you talk to the general public. You just talk to any, you know, so the general, what they say, you know, so the man on the street cutting
argument. That's it, yeah.
We all know we all know that it's hard to negotiate bureaucracy.
Yes.
It's very hard to engage public debate into how bureaucracies are organized.
Yeah, okay, because they expect bureaucracies to be organized
and
in a Byzantine
it's
way.
It's like Senate reform. Everybody knows it's not good, but no, you know, we're all just, we can't think about it anymore. It's just way too complicated.
Yeah.
And nobody actually, I mean, that's why this kind of denial by process is so successful, is because it is something that the overwhelming majority of us presume is a problem, but also presume that there's just nothing you can do. It's always like that.
So do you feel that this is an inadvertent or overlooked continuation of a previously meant to be disqualifying process, or do you think that this is an endorsement of disqualification by process?
Look, I will simply use the language that one uses as a lawyer, which says they either knew or should have known.
Okay, yeah. Yeah,
because
I agree. Yeah.
When one looks at this, exactly the same process, exactly the same forms in other places, they had exactly the same effect.
Yes.
So they either knew or should have known.
Yes. Okay.
That this would be the result of setting up an administrative process. I mean, setting up a voicemail system where the only way you can actually start the benefit process is, take the example of OW, by undergoing a 45-minute phone interview presupposes not only that you've got phones, but that you're capable of talking on the phone.
For 45 minutes.
For 45 minutes. That is not going to freak you out, that you're going to get yourself through that.
Well, and that you're physically able to attend to a phone for 45 minutes, which a lot of people with physical injuries are not.
And all of us with cognitive disabilities, that you can keep your focus on the phone for that long.
That's true.
There's a whole series of... Now, this is not a particularly complicated observation.
Yeah, it's true.
It's not earth-shattering, it's not staggering, it's not unusual, it's not any of the above.
Or the product of deep analysis, no.
No, this is just, oh yeah, there are going to be people who are going to have a whole lot of trouble doing that.
Yeah.
Now, if you and I over a phone conversation can make that observation, it's a little difficult to understand how it could be have been completely overlooked by the king of forms, the person, the set of people that actually set up the system.
Right.
This is not overwhelmingly deep analysis.
Or endorse the system after it's been set up.
Yeah. The question is, you know, they endorse it based, but they also ordered it. They hired this company to set up this program.
Yeah.
In this context.
Mm-hmm.
This is not as though it's something that sort of showed up out of nowhere.
And now for a short break from our interview. You've been listening to lawyer Sarah Chartall explain why denial by process is so effective for the Ontario government.
This is not only a program that's failing the disabled, as Andre Marin noted, but it's unsuited to people who are homeless.
It's not a question of being unsuited. If one de-aggregates homelessness.
All right.
And one says, okay, so who are the homeless, who are the different groups of people who are homeless?
Right.
You have one group of people who end up homeless who are women with kids.
Right.
Who end up homeless after the breakup of a marriage or a partnership in which the cost of living in an apartment has been borne up until that point by two people.
Mm-hmm.
The family breaks up. There's only one person. As a result, you can't make the rent. You lose housing and you end up homeless. That's one group of people. You've got another group of people who had a job, lost a job, ran out of money, but are looking for another job.
Mm-hmm.
You've got another group of people who come in from someplace else to look for a job, don't have a job, are temporarily homeless. Then you have another subgroup of people who tend to be what are called the chronically homeless.
Right.
They're people, statistically, who end up being on the street for quite a long time, usually several years.
Right.
Now, the question we need to ask ourselves is, why are they homeless?
All right.
When you're looking at the group of people who are chronically homeless, people don't sprout homeless. You're looking at people who...
People come from homes, mostly.
Who had homes and who lost them, and who, for most of their adult lives, went in and out of work. On the whole, they're not congenitally disabled, because those people tend to move into systems. They're born with a disability. You see it when you're a child. You see it when you're an infant. You go on to public programs. What we're seeing on the whole are people who may or may not have had some amount of congenital disability, but who for most of their lives would go on and off work.
All right.
Two things happen in the mid-90s which shift the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Up until 1996, 97, the people paid into the unemployment insurance program.
Mm-hmm.
Under UIC, both UIC and EI carry with them most people's only sick benefit program.
That's right.
Right? Most of us work in places that have no sick benefits.
Right.
Our only sick benefits either come from UIC or EI.
Mm-hmm.
UIC only required that you have 20 weeks work. They didn't care how many hours.
Yeah.
You could work part-time, you could work contract, didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you, in a claim year, you had 20 weeks. I've been working with folks, homeless folks with disabilities, and this is actually the heart of what we found when we did the Street Health Project, which is the largest mass study of chronic homelessness and benefit programs. This was a special project. We just released it, the final findings.
I recall that.
That's right. It was funded by the Wellesley Hospital. And
oh, okay.
We started from a different question. We said, well, if we've got benefit programs, why are these people homeless to begin with, and is there anything we can do about it?
All right.
And what we found when we did the work and we went back through it is that almost everyone, sort of, I think it's something like 98.3 of everyone in the population that we worked with, had been on UIC sick at some point in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But what immediately happens when UIC is repealed and EI is brought in, under EI, to get access to any kind of benefits, including sick benefits,
right,
you need 700 hours.
Ah.
The overwhelming majority of people who are working with chronic disabilities never manage to work 700 hours before they experience a health crisis.
I see.
It's really about the fact that you can't get your foot in the door, that initial...
It's basically 20 weeks full-time without a day off.
You got it.
Yeah.
And most of the folks that we deal with can work episodically, they can work part-time, they can work contract, they can work on and off.
Yeah.
But 700 hours is incredibly difficult for them to do medically. So the immediate thing that happens, which had never happened to them before, was that when the acute health crisis started,
mm-hmm,
they have no income.
All right.
Right?
Right.
So at the point at which whatever combinations of physical health, mental health, infectious health, addictions, whatever,
mm-hmm,
became so acute that they could not drag themselves into work.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of what had happened before, taking some time off, going on, you know, getting a doctor's note, going on sick benefits, recovering, and then going back to work, which is how their lives had been run up till then.
Yeah.
The immediate thing that happens is they have no income.
Right.
At the point at which they cannot work.
And as a consequence, they lose their housing.
At the point they lose the housing, at the point then the question becomes, homelessness, as we know, doesn't usually create health crisis.
Health crisis creates homelessness.
Health crisis creates homelessness. What homelessness tends to do is to make
it worse.
Make it worse.
Yeah.
With the exceptions of things like chronic depression, which set in secondary to the misery of finding out that you can't pull yourself out of this and this is what you're facing. Basically, homelessness makes a whole lot of other things worse, but it doesn't actually create them.
Okay.
But what triggers the fall to homelessness for this group of people,
yeah,
tends to be a health crisis.
All right.
Then the problem becomes, once it's already been triggered,
yeah,
the programs that should pick up people for long-term health-related benefits,
mm-hmm,
Mm-hmm. There are three of them, three in various alternative situations.
Mm-hmm.
ODSP is the biggest,
mm-hmm.
but there's also Canada Pension Disability System and the Workers' Compensation System.
Mm-hmm.
Almost always takes such a long time to make a decision that by the time they've made a decision,
mm-hmm.
someone has already fallen through to homelessness.
Right. Now, when they've fallen through to homelessness, how do the programs apply?
Well, the point is they can apply, but you have to have a great deal of sort of contact and tenacity and forbearance to get through them.
That's true.
So the problem becomes what we've been doing and what we've seen through the studies is that what we're actually doing is this kind of remedial work in which we get people back onto programs they should have been on.
Right.
Then reestablish entitlement to money, and then from there get them back into housing.
Okay.
The Street Health study has a phenomenal success rate.
Okay.
We actually worked with the total study as opposed to the more limited study that we did the statistics on, but the total study included in the course of 18 months 126 people.
All right.
Now of those, one person I decided was probably not disabled to the standard required by ODSP. So we have one that we actually think was not disabled enough
right.
to qualify for ODSP. We have nine who died while we were waiting to get decisions done in their cases.
I see.
And we have...
Out of 126.
Out of 126. And we got 116 onto benefits and housed. That's incredibly time-consuming, but that's 126 people that in the course of 18 months we got benefits and housed.
Okay.
See, one has to understand that, you know, unless you actually believe that homelessness is voluntary, you then have to ask yourself, well, what the hell are they doing there?
Yeah.
And is there anything we can do about it? I mean, is there anything that, why is it that the system is so hard?
What are the things that we can do about it?
Well, there are a whole lot of things we can do about them.
Before you get into that, you did mention two changes that brought this about. And one was you made quite clear, was the change in qualifying hours for EI.
Yes.
What was the other?
The other is the enactment of ODSP. The enactment of ODSP as opposed to FBA.
The what of ODSP?
The enactment, the legal...
Oh, I see, the creation of ODSP.
The creation of the ODSP system. And it's particularly time-consuming bureaucracy. I mean, the FBA was never a particularly good system.
All right.
But ODSP is much worse.
Okay.
It's one of the sort of, for those of us who have worked with these systems for a long time, I mean, one of the things that I thought would never happen is that
Someone
the problems we now have made the old systems actually look good relative to the misery. You know, they were miserable then.
Yes.
These are just much worse.
Yeah.
We're talking about why are the systems that are supposed to cover people who cannot work because of health reasons so hard to access?
Okay.
It's a much simpler question, and it's important to not...
So this is about money.
This is always about money.
Yeah. Okay.
This is completely and totally and utterly about money.
All right.
It says, what do you do? Where can you get any money at the point at which you can no longer work because you are too sick to work?
Okay. So you had a very specific focus for this. And
this is about money. It's about benefit systems.
Right.
Which is why I said people glaze over when you start talking about it. I started doing this work long before we started the project, originally as a volunteer group, because I got a little annoyed that everybody talked about homelessness as if it was always about the buildings.
Oh, okay.
It's always about the money.
All right.
I mean, no money, no rent. This is not rocket science.
All right.
Fundamentally, there's a little bit of, homelessness is not necessarily about the housing. It's about the money to pay for housing.
Yeah.
And if we step back from, you know, is there housing, isn't there housing, is there any money to pay for it?
Yeah.
No housing is affordable with no money.
Yeah. Gotcha.
This comes out of the understanding that, you know, you don't even get on the agenda,
yeah.
even for public housing, if you have no income. We need to look at the system and say, is it reasonable that it's organized this way?
Yes.
And if that's not reasonable, how should it be organized?
Right.
There's a lot to be done.
Poor People's lawyer, Sarah Chartal, a lawyer at Roach Schwartz and Associates, to discuss denial by process in ODSP and the class action lawsuit launched by her firm.
That's right.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
All right.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
In the middle of the show, you heard Pete Johnson and Albert Ammon's Barrel House Boogie. And coming up, a little swing and boogie, Woody Herman, Chips Boogie Woogie, from Deja Vu Retro Gold Collection's Encyclopedia of Boogie Woogie. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.